Hello listeners, and welcome to the Resilience Research Group seminar series. In this podcast, we will be discussing resilience in the context of grief and bereavement with Dr. Christopher Lane from Nova Southeastern University in Florida. I'm Shihui. I'm a master's student in psychology at UCL, and I'm conducting this interview on behalf of the Resilience Research Group. So Dr. Lane, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, it's a delight to be on this call. And to talk about my resilience research. I've been doing this work, I would say, since at least the late 1990s, when I was a postdoctoral fellow through the UCLA Trauma Psychiatry Service in post-war Bosnia. And so it's a delight, actually, to be able to revisit some of my former work and also to catch our audience up on my more recent work as well.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Right. So I guess, Chris, just to start off in the introduction section, just what made you interested in studying resilience?
I would say it started very early on in the 1990s when I was working at a school-based mental health clinic up on the north side of Los Angeles. I was at the time as a graduate student at UCLA. And what started off as sort of a standard externship eventually over time evolved into a three-year extended stay there as both an extern as well as turning into my doctoral dissertation work. So I had a chance, along with a few members of the clinic staff who helped me, to be able to interview a little over 70 kids who had been exposed to community violence. And I became really fascinated not only with their stories, but also just simply by how well many of them were doing. It was astonishing. Many of them, frankly, were living with their families in garages. Many of them were very low income, et cetera, had very limited opportunities, and yet many of them were actually doing remarkably well. I would say that's the early origins. And also when I was reading for my doctoral dissertation, there was a classic chapter written by Robert Pinus, one of my mentors, Alan Steinberg, another one of my mentors, and Ruth Wraith, published in 1995 in an edited volume by Dante Giacchetti, where they lay out sort of the developmental psychopathology of childhood traumatic stress. And in their particular conceptual model, they make a key distinction between resistance and resilience. And I really became very interested in that whole business of, you know, why do they make a conceptual distinction? Why do they enter at different points in the model? And what are the implications actually for studying them and also for being able to intervene, particularly with respect to be able to identify who's at risk for what types of adverse outcomes over time? So that was, I would credit that in particular. Also, when you read more recent work, for example, Chris Bruin's work, his meta-analytic studies, for example, risk factors for PTSD, in many cases, one of the most potent contributory factors that he was able to identify was an absence of social support. And that really became very interesting to me as well, because that is something that you could consider to be therapeutically modifiable. That's something that you can actually target and change. So if you read, for example, also Benjamin Gottlieb, some of the work that he's done on social support, it's very interesting to see that social support, frankly, is a naturally occurring process. It's something that all of us, we hope, are doing all of the time. And it's something that you actually only graft on if it's really in deficit, for example, and for example, people are grappling with a stigmatized death and they're really deficient in social support. That's something where you graft on additional socially supportive relationships. But for the most part, for 98%, 99% of people, these are naturally occurring processes. And so how do they actually operate not only with therapeutic augmentation, but how do they actually operate in the real world? So once again, I could go on, but for me, those are some really sort of key moments that influence my thinking.
Thank you so much. That was a really, really interesting answer. So when we talked about resistance and resilience, so this actually segues to the next question that I wanted to ask. So I guess there's always been an overlap of some sort between these two definitions or these two terms. So you mentioned at the 2004 symposium that there was a lack of sophisticated studies in the field of resilience, and there was a lot of maybe confusion between the terms being interchangeably used. So what made you say that we needed more sophisticated studies in the field?
In some ways, I have to give credit where credit is due. It came from a tongue lashing that an invited, actually a keynote address speaker, delivered at ISTSS, that's International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. It's one of the flagship organizations for researchers and practitioners in the area of traumatic stress. So Norman Garmazy is one of the founding pioneers of developmental psychopathology. And so he was invited to come in and speak to us. And frankly, we were sort of, as sometimes happens, expecting, I think, I was a young fellow at the time, but, you know, them to come in and sort of be very, very gracious and to talk about what important work we're doing and what advances we're doing, et cetera. Instead, he was sort of cranky, if you want to think about it that way. And he basically said, y'all are primitive in your conceptual framework and your terminology, et cetera. He actually took a book that he'd purchased, read something in there about resilience, and basically held it up to the audience and said, anyone want to buy a book? Which is sort of how cranky he was. What his point was that we had actually missed out. Almost nobody in our field was reading up on 15 years at the time in the developmental psychopathology field. And he said, there's so much that our field could do to actually enrich yours, and you're not making good use of it. And your, you know, your terms are very simplistic. Your models are simplistic. Your implications for intervention are simplistic. And so, frankly, I took that as a constructive butt kicking and built that into a 2007, a 2004 invited symposium, but also in a 2007 chapter where I actually begin with Garmazy's tongue lashing of our society and talking about the fact that that was 10 years before, this is in 2007. And really, how much work have we, how much progress have we actually made? So returning back to the 2004 symposium, I really got to drill down. And I had a research lab at the time, and we focused on resistance and resilience, et cetera. We did LUT searches, and we actually found that people were using the terms resilience, but in many cases, they were actually not using equally applicable terms like stress resistance, for instance. And they weren't talking about developmental trajectories, et cetera. So in many cases, to be honest, our candid assessment in 2004 and back in 2007 at the book chapter that I wrote with a good number of authors was that we're really not, we're spinning our wheels in lots of conceptual mud, and that we need to have a lot more conceptual clarity if we're going to be able to make sophisticated advances with respect to theory building, research methodology, and also being able to lay out the implications that they carry, because they're different for implication and policy, advocacy, et cetera.
I see. So I guess on your own terms, how would you define a sophisticated study? Because we talk about maybe better clarity of terms and research methodologies, yeah. But just some, yeah.
So I'm going to try to distill this down into a couple of observations here. But what we're really talking about is that there are dyssynchronies that emerge in our field. So, for example, people will make a conceptual advance that is not met in a commensurate manner with research methodology. So I remember talking, for example, with one of Ann Mastin's very talented researchers, graduate students, and she would sort of say, listen, I go to these conferences and people come in with these extraordinarily sophisticated, elaborate theories. And then they turn around and they present results using something as simple as multiple regression, for instance. So you can have a dyssynchrony where you have sophisticated conceptual frameworks, and then you actually have rather basic statistics. But you can also have the other kind of dyssynchrony, and that is, and this oftentimes happens with young graduate students, for example, and, you know, postdoctoral fellows, et cetera. So they're schooled in the most sophisticated statistical techniques. But in many cases, they're sort of throwing them at the data in ways that, you know, latent groups, latent group modeling, for example, or latent growth curve modeling, et cetera. And we sort of say, okay, so where's the commensurate commensurate conceptual and theoretical sophistication that helps us to be able to recognize that this is not just simply more than throwing advanced statistical package spaghetti at the wall and sort of extracting things, but they don't necessarily know what to do about it, particularly with respect to laying out implications for theory building and for intervention. So what I'm really talking about is a commensurate interdigitation, that is symmetric growth with respect to both theory building and statistical research methods. And it takes a lot of work to be able to do that. We have really good theoreticians in the field, We also have some really good, you know, sophisticated types of statistical methodology and so forth. But to find groups of people who are actually capable of doing both is a much more rare find. And I'm saying that on the basis of being an invited reviewer for many journal articles. I can talk a little bit more about that if you want.
Yes, please go ahead.
Sure. I learned, so if I can sort of share what's kind of funny about this, and I can talk about this more and more talking about how to advance the field, but it sort of surprises me once again when I read articles by very talented young researchers where they are now articulating the very arguments that I laid out back in 2004 and 2007 and 2010, et cetera, as if these are new concepts. And so what I would basically say is that one of the things that I've learned is how hard you actually have to work, how much time you have to dedicate to actually reading the work of people who've come before. So let me give you a couple of examples. So my own sort of mentors. So Philip Tsai, for example, I had an interesting conversation with him. He's done some great work, for example, on links between trauma and PTSD and academic performance. I read a chapter of his where he actually was citing the diary of Samuel Pepys, which is probably much better known in England than it is here in the United States. But it's a very famous diary of somebody who actually lived, among other things, through the Great Fire of London. And he records in his diary that he actually was awoken by nightmares of the fire. It's actually one of the first recorded instances of PTSD. And I said, how did you ever come across that? And he said, I went to the library. I forced myself to go to the library and just sit and read for weeks. And that's how I found it. You know, and so, for example, Robert Pinus and I were assigned to work on the multidimensional grief theory. This is chapter 2 of a recently published multidimensional grief theory manual that came out in 2023. So we were working on that for the better part of a year, actually very close to a year. But we really spent the time, and Robert Pinus knows this literature times 40 something years, but we really went back and revisited a lot of the old books and so forth, many of which are out of print, and really tried to learn more about the historical origins of the theory itself. So for example, I'll be talking about this later more, but where does the notion of circumstance-related distress come from? That is distress over how a person died. You can actually trace that back, for example, to all sorts of historical reference, but one of them actually has to do with the Coconut Grove fire in Boston, which happened during World War II in the early 1940s. So a lot of the early work, for example, on traumatic bereavement, for example, and sort of the origin of traumatic grief actually came out of the work of studying the survivors of that fire. Well, you know, that's 80 years ago. But what's so interesting about a lot of these things is that if you're actually able to trace things back to their historical origins, it not only makes it things far more gripping, by the way, and I teach graduate students and it's easy for them to lose attention. So all the more interesting anecdotal stories, for example, about how these things originally came to be. What's particularly interesting, frankly, is that, you know, some of it's the team that were working on grief reactions in the aftermath of the Coconut Grove fire. They themselves originally studied phantom limb pain. So in other words, they were actually studying pain that exists from a body part that had heretofore been connected to them and no longer was. And so it's very interesting to see actually that some of the historical origins of grief came out of a group that was actually sort of schematic for studying phantom limb pain. So, I mean, things like that for me are very interesting. It's like, wow, that's really where it came from. And you can find all sorts of other historical antecedents. So in other words, another example would be Jonathan Shea. I had a chance to speak with him at an ESTSS conference, European Society for Traumatic Stress Studies, up in Edinburgh. Some 20 years ago, fascinating conversationalist, but he himself wrote Achilles in Vietnam. And so you actually find some of the historical reference for actually combat fatigue. You know, he was a VA psychiatrist working with survivors, if you will, vets who'd been through the Vietnam War. And he was absolutely stunned at the parallels between, you know, the story of Achilles, for example, and the old Trojan Wars, for example, and what the survivors of Vietnam were coming back with and their difficulties with being able to adjust. So I'm really sold on the idea of tracing things back to the historical origin. It provides so much more richness to things. It makes them much more interesting, but also provides a lot more nuance. And I mean, even split plot designs, for example, in statistics, that actually came from agriculture. Plots were plots of land. You know, so just recognizing the fact that these things actually had pragmatic solutions to then serious problems, challenges, you know, and so a lot of the things that we study now originally had a very pragmatic application. People were trying to solve a problem that was a problem for them then. And for me, it adds that richness, but it also helps to underscore just simply how pragmatic and how useful a lot of these concepts are when you understand the purposes for which they were originally developed. And then now we can, of course, extrapolate and start thinking about how we can use them now.
I see. That was really interesting because you mentioned about complex statistics methods. And I just remembered my dissertation supervisor saying that a really, really good study, you just need like the basic statistics to sort of explain it clearly, and as well as explaining the results, explaining good theoretical results with like base statistics. So I thought that was really interesting that you brought that up. And thank you as well for the talking about problem solving, you know, using problem solving strategies to address problems in the past and sort of relating how to current problems that we have now. Mm-hmm. So I guess since maybe the 2004 symposium or your 2007 paper, have you noticed any significant changes in the field? So has there been more sophisticated studies in that sense?
I would say yes. And in fact, I mean, for instance, I just read a beautiful, elegant paper by Anne Mastin and Dinah Jacketti. It's wonderful that they continue to produce excellent work after decades of contributions to the field. But I would qualify that. I would say yes, but not enough. And once again, sort of returning to my former point is that people keep on reinventing the wheel. You know, I read things, for example, points that people are making, you know, in 2024 that we made back in 2004 or 2007, 2010, et cetera, 2012. So sometimes I'll very politely follow up with people and simply say, you may be interested in this line of research because we actually raise the same points and we actually really drill down on this particular topic. I hope I don't overwhelm people when I send them articles, but in many cases, there are like 6, 8, 10, you know, pieces that even my own research team has developed that are directly relevant. A good friend of mine, for example, was Boyd James. Now, he came from Trinidad Tobago, so I'm not going to try to reenact his wonderful, rich Caribbean accent. But he said one time, just talking, he said, people do not read enough. He said, you know, after you get your doctorate degree, he said, you should be given a stipend and just allowed to read for a year or two. Not even be forced to do research, just read and acquaint yourself with the literature. And so I guess my point is that it's difficult sometimes for people to discern about whether something is literally revisiting or reinventing the wheel. So I'm sort of in some ways a little grumpy, like Norman Garmazie was talking about sort of a revisitation of the past. But in some cases, there are truly substantive advances that are being made in the field. So wonderful, for example, advances are being made in neuroscience, for example, and really trying to map out, for example, you know, the neurobiology, not only of post-traumatic stress disorder, but also of grief reactions and so forth. And really, where does that come from? And what are the mechanisms at you know, the level of biology, as well as our social relationships and our thoughts, et cetera? What are the mechanisms by which people actually resiliently recover? As well as what are the difficult points for people who actually have a very protracted recovery curve or actually who do not recover? So those for me remain very interesting problems. So I'd like to see, once again, the commensurate sort of sophistication of both research methods and theory, and then laying them out also. Because any advance, and if I can, I'm going to try and show this for our audience right here. So I'm going to show something. This is from a 2014 symposium right here. And so for people who've actually seen Back to the Future, this is a bit of an homage to Dr. Emmett Brown, you know, the ultimate egghead. but he developed what we call a flux capacitor. And we became very interested in ways in which we can actually foster the rapid evolution of the grief field. So this was inspired in part from listening to Richard Bryant, who at the time was working on coming up with proposed criteria for prolonged grief disorder. So he was speaking at ISTSS and he said, if we're speaking candidly, the field of bereavement and grief is 20 years behind that of PTSD. And also speaking candidly, I was as a grief researcher and clinician in the area, particularly of bereaved adolescents and children, I would say that the child and adolescent bereavement and grief literature is oftentimes 10 years behind of that of the adults. So the problem, a very pragmatic one we were trying to come up with, was how do you jump ahead in time? You know, and so how do we actually make more rapid and efficient evolutionary leaps? So in other words, it takes us not 30 years to catch up on 30 years gap. And so that was this idea, that sort of a core of discovery model. But if you look at this, and I'm going to describe it, it actually has seven different dial points. The original flux capacitor had three. But in this one, we actually have seven dial points that are all converging on a core of discovery, which is sort of a little bit like a nuclear reaction, okay? But the idea is that if we are simultaneously engaged in theory building, test construction, naturalistic studies, oftentimes longitudinal, intervention development and evaluation, education and training, both in graduate school, postdoctoral training, and of course, in-service training of practicing professionals, then dissemination science and implementation and public policy. So these are all sort of seven radial arms that all converge. And the idea is that if we make an advance in one area, for example, we might be interviewing a kid, for example, or assessing a kid with respect to intervention, we might have wonderful insights, for instance, that lend themselves to theory building. We gain some insights, for example, into what circumstance-related distress may look like in its phenomenology. But that also helps us to write better test items when we engage in test construction. So the idea is that, just along with a fission reaction, you know, we have, protons are bouncing around all over the place. The idea is that ideas are bouncing all around in this model. So you can have an advance in theory building that carries forward into test construction or into education and training, et cetera. So that was sort of the original idea that we came up with, my presenter's eye in this symposium here, is how do we make 30 years of progress in less than 30 years? So I'm going to stop sharing and we can go back to our conversation.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I just want to say I literally watched Back to the Future last night. And it was amazing. It was an amazing show, right? But you bring up the flux capacitor, and I was just, yeah, it was a really good show. And yeah, and thank you as well for the diagram. It was really clear. And I guess moving on to more of like in detail about your research on grief and bereavement. So you mentioned in your 2017 paper to differentiate between post-traumatic stress as well as grief reactions. So for our listeners, could you please explain what you mean by that and why is there a need for such distinction?
Yeah. It is easy to conceptually conflate post-traumatic stress reactions with grief reactions. And frankly, when you use terminology like traumatic grief or childhood traumatic grief, it can add itself to that. So let me sort of step back here for a minute and just simply say there are many different levels at which we can analyze this problem. But one of the most compelling for me is just simply when you sit down and you talk with bereaved kids. And, you know, I've worked with bereaved kids, for example, who've lost a loved one under peaceful circumstances. You might have, for example, an adolescent who lives with his beloved grandmother. Parents are out of the picture for one reason or another. And she may live a long life, but she dies a peaceful death. It's actually not traumatic, but it's deeply tragic for him. And this youth, for example, may have some powerful grief reactions. For example, you can have separation distress, which is intense pining and yearning and longing to be physically reunited. You can have an existential personal crisis, which is basically the will to live or a sense of purpose and meaning to your life, which can then lead to sort of a meandering way of approaching life where it seems purposeless and aimless, and it's difficult to get out of bed in the morning. People can conflate that with depression, by the way. You can have an identity crisis where you feel like the best part of you died with a person who died. where you sort of lose your sense of morality, your sense of personal identity. You may lose sort of your own personal values, your own moorings that sort of keep you anchored in life, et cetera. So there are lots of different ways in which you can actually develop grief reactions, but from non-traumatic deaths that do not meet PTSD criteria in hand, that actually don't overlap with the phenomenology of PTSD. And you can also just simply have a lot of distress over the manner of death. You didn't get to say goodbye, for example, or during COVID. You know, people died with respirators on, alone, et cetera. So they're just deeply tragic elements of those deaths. But nevertheless, they actually don't meet PTSD criteria in aid. So just simply one source of information I would draw is just simply that it's easy for us to conflate these things. But on the other hand, grief and its phenomenology is so powerfully different from PTSD. It's very important to be able to conceptually unpack them. Just one anecdote, when we do training, for example, with staff who work with juvenile justice youth, for instance, incarcerated youth, and we train in both PTSD-focused work in one of our treatment modules, but then we also focus on loss-focused work, grief and loss-focused work, and we sort of lay out multidimensional grief theory. Oftentimes, the response that we get back is, you just described our kids far better using a grief lens than we've ever been able to see and understand and intervene with them using a traumatic stress lens. Wow. So in other words, it actually has a lot more sort of explanatory power and a lot more sort of clinical utility because it helps you figure out what to do as opposed to just simply building a trauma narrative. To go on just a little bit, some of that early work actually traces back to some pioneering work that was done by Robert Pinus. Back in 1992, he wrote a classic paper where he laid out the core distinction between post-traumatic stress reactions and grief reactions, et cetera. You know, I've done quite a bit of work building on that over time, but what I would like to really underscore right here is that post-traumatic stress reactions are oftentimes evoked by trauma reminders, or they're cues that remind you of actually how the person died. So it could be, you know, gunshots, for example, or it could be the sight of an ambulance, whatever it is, things that are connected to the manner of death. And actually maybe the people who notified you that now become trauma reminders, which can lead to interpersonal estrangements. But loss reminders actually remind you of the ongoing loss of the person, their physical absence from your life, and the ongoing deprivations and hardships that you experience. It could be the person's name, for example, it could be their photograph, it could be their favorite, you know, meal, or their favorite perfume, it could be their song on the radio, etc. It could be times when you come home and the house is empty, it could be times when you have an exam and you want somebody to help you study. You know, it could be, you know, I want to learn how to ride a bike and I don't have my dad here, etc. So there can be lots of different types of reminders, but these are actually quite distinct. And so if you lay out trauma reminders and loss reminders, as I did over in Bosnia, for example, they break out very cleanly and distinctly in different factors. They don't behave the same way empirically. And we would actually argue they're actually very, very different and they evoke different types of reactions. And that's a really important part of psychoeducation and what we do. What sort of pulls up grief reactions? What pulls up post-traumatic stress reactions? We help people be able to identify those reminders and then develop coping strategies with which to anticipate them and cope with them in adaptive ways.
Thank you so much. I think, yeah, you really have to sort of distinguish between the two. And I think you also mentioned earlier at the start, but can you maybe also talk about how the circumstances or reasons of death will affect how a bereaved person, a loved one, grieve and as well as build resilience?
Mm-hmm. Some of the work I'm thinking right here is Edward Reinerson's work. He's done some extraordinary work, you know, over the last 30 years, really talking about how people who are bereaved under traumatic or at least tragic circumstances can develop reactions. And it's not just post-traumatic stress reactions, but actually different types of grief reactions as well. So I think what's important to keep in mind with respect to understanding different ways in which the circumstances of the death can actually affect the course of grieving. From a sort of a classic traumatic grief perspective, of course, losing people under traumatic circumstances, for instance, somebody is killed in an accident, somebody is murdered, for example, somebody takes their life through suicide, somebody accidentally overdoses, et cetera. Or, you know, if you read a classic paper by Makari et al., I think back in 2013, Medical error was like the third leading cause of death in the United States. So medical error actually is a potent contributing factor to many deaths. And this is before COVID. So bottom line is, sometimes there can be truly traumatic circumstances of the death, but there also can be things that we would say are wrongful deaths. That is, they deserved to die in a better way. So they died alone, for example. They died without me being able to tell them that how much I loved them, et cetera, or be able to make peace with them. And those sorts of circumstances oftentimes can really torment people who've lost people under those circumstances. So they can be really perplexed and greatly preoccupied by what that death was like for the person they go through, and how things could and should have been different, for example. If only they would have been able to intervene in time, for example, or only if the appropriate tests would have been ordered, et cetera, by a doctor or psychologist, et cetera. So there are many different ways in which circumstances of death can make it much more difficult for people to be able to grieve. The grief reactions themselves can manifest as, more classic PTSD symptoms, true. But there can also be lots of other ways in which people are mentally preoccupied in very, very distressing ways about how the person died that do not meet criterion A and that cannot be classified as a PTSD reaction. And so just recognizing the many different ways. I mean, a child, for example, may have an exaggerated sense of responsibility that somehow she contributed to the death of her father. We ran into that many times over in Bosnia because kids were angry at their father because their father would come home on leave and then go back to the front. And they were very angry at their dad for feeling, accused him of abandoning their family. And then he's killed. And some of the girls, for example, we talked with in the group that I attended, were very remorseful about the circumstances under which they parted with their fathers and wondered about, for example, whether their fathers had actually felt guilty and didn't take care of them themselves as much and weren't as careful on the front lines, et cetera. So there can be many different ways in which people feel that they may have actually contributed to the way in which the person died. And it could be acts of omission as well as commission, things that I should have done but didn't do, as well as things that I actually did. I can give you another example. This is what happened with when we were doing work in the aftermath of September 11th. But, there were young people, for example, who overslept their alarm and missed the bus. And so their parent took them to school earlier than they would normally have left for work. And so actually dropped the kid off at school and then was in the building well before they would normally arrive there, just in time for the planes to hit. And so, in other words, missing school somehow was causally connected, to having a parent in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so once again, things like this can greatly perplex people and make them feel that they've somehow contributed inadvertently, involuntarily, to a death. And that becomes a major part of, if you will, what we call circumstance-related distress.
And building on to that point, are there specific techniques or research or therapies to sort of deal with survivor's guilt or to deal with the guilt that many loved ones feel?
Yes. Yes. And so, by disclosure, I'm a co-author of five different manuals, including trauma and grief component therapy for adolescents and multidimensional grief therapy. Both of them were published by Cambridge University Press. But both of them explicitly focus on what we call circumstance-related distress. So these are different conceptual domains of multidimensional grief theory. One has to do with separation distress. Another is focusing on identity and existential-related distress. And the third is circumstance-related distress, or primary conceptual dimensions of this theory. And so there are a variety of different interventions that we actually use to help people who are grappling with distress over how a person died. In many cases, that this has to do with engaging in positive social action. So, for example, people oftentimes can find a sense of relief and can channel their pain and their frustration, their vexation, by engaging in positive social action. It can actually be advocacy. It can be helping other people who are facing similar circumstances. It can be focusing on prevention, et cetera, or providing comfort and solace to people who've been through these types of experiences. But oftentimes that's something that we find when people who are towards the end of the treatment, they oftentimes have more sort of psychic resources, and they actually become a lot more oriented toward providing support for others. So they become, if you will, a lot more altruistic in their orientation. And that's oftentimes a sign of the treatment, if you will, working, is that people move from a preoccupation with their own pain to actually helping others who are in experiencing a lot of pain over how a person died.
I see. Thank you. And bringing back to your point earlier, where you said that research for youth and children facing grief is 10 years behind adult populations. So what is sort of the difference in the way adults grieve and maybe how youths grieve?
Yes. Now, let me say that was an observation that I made, you know, back a few years ago. We're actually doing our very best to try to catch up. But I wouldn't hold myself to the 10-year rule even right now. But one of the things, if you will, when you sit back and sort of critique the literature, one of the primary problems has to do with sort of the siloing or the sequestration of different research teams. And that is, we have different research teams, for example, examining adults versus children. And oftentimes they have different theoretical orientations, for example. One might be rooted in attachment theory, for example, and we're using multidimensional grief theory, which includes attachment theory. But they also might be using different research methods. They might be using, and certainly different research measures. So, you know, one of the reasons, that was actually one of the primary reasons why I've spent time actually developing two different versions of the prolonged grief disorder checklist, one for children and adolescents and the other for adults, is so that we actually have a common pair of measures that can actually be used. They're essentially similar. There are a few developmental modifications, et cetera, but that actually is going to allow us to being able to examine at a symptom by symptom level, actually at the item by item level, the correspondence between, say, bereaved caregivers, parents, and bereaved children. And so I would argue that some of the differences that we see maybe aren't methodological artifacts, simply because, once again, different teams, different methods, different measures, et cetera. But so I would say the evidence, we don't have really good, clear, compelling evidence about this. We have some preliminary evidence, for example, on our side, that different dimensions of grief actually may be more salient at different developmental periods. So, for example, children and adolescents, for example, children may have more prominent separation distress, pining, yearning, longing, for example. They're inconsolable. They sit next to the door, for instance. Whereas existential and identity-related challenges seem to be more characteristic of adults. And that was something that we wrote up, for example, in our report to the American Psychiatric Association back in 2019 and 2020, where we sort of laid that out. So I would say the evidence is sufficient that we were able, if you will, to persuade the American Psychiatric Association to make some developmental modifications to prolonged grief disorder. So in particular, we have 6 months, for example, must have passed, not 12 months, since the person died. And criterion B2, which is a preoccupation with a person who died, we augmented, we enlarged, so it actually now also includes preoccupation with how they died. And we did that in part because we wanted to make sure that we have room in there for kids who are really distressed over how they died, but in ways that do not meet PTSD criterion A, because people can have a lot of concerns about how somebody died that falls well within sort of, we would argue, a grief construct and is not PTSD.
Okay. Thank you so much. So I guess, when it comes to sort of comforting or helping someone that is currently grieving, I think a lot of people have the consensus that they want to help, but they don't want to say something wrong or make things worse. So I think from, you know, as an expert in the field, what can the average person do to help like a close friend or a family member deal who is currently grieving?
Mm-hmm. I think that there are a good number of things that can be done. For people who are particularly interested, there's a brochure developed by Dr. Julie Kaplow and myself about grieving, how to help grieving kids over the holidays, that if you do a quick search, you're going to be able to find. That contains a good amount of sort of pragmatic advice. But what I would do is, I think it's sometimes helpful to sort of lay out the conceptual dimensions of multidimensional grief theory and say, what are the primary coping challenges associated with each domain? Well, separation distress, the primary coping challenge is how do I feel connected to this person now that they're physically absent from my life? And so frankly, doing things like remembering and reminiscing, for instance, and developing a mental, a collection of mementos, for instance, being able to just simply talk about the person, or also talking about how you are like the person or how they are like you, can actually be quite comforting. You know, if you like the Harry Potter movies, think of how many times Harry Potter is sort of consoled with the idea that his parents are still with him, because in many ways he actually has their physical attributes as well as their character attributes. You have your mother's eyes, for example, your father's, you know, spirit, etc., and prowess at Quidditch. So the idea here is, how do we feel a sense of continuing connection in ways that actually help us to be able to move forward with our life's journey? We don't sort of developmentally freeze or regress in order to remain connected to them, because that can actually be, if you will, a maladaptive. We would propose a maladaptive response to that is I need to remain rooted in my childhood because that's when I lost my father. So one of the ways in which we can help people, once again, is to be able to help them develop a sense of continuing connection. So I can continue to grow and develop. I'm now, you know, I lost my father, for example, when I was 9, and now I'm 12, or now I'm 14. How can I continue to sense a sense of connection with my father in ways where I'm actually able to upgrade my memories and relate to him like a 14-year-old or like a 16-year-old or a 22-year-old, et cetera? Because the relationship actually needs to change over time. It needs to develop in ways that help you to be able to meet your needs with being able to connect with the person who died. With respect to existential and identity, can we help people, for instance, to be able, in some cases, they actually have to remember who they are, or you know, or their sense of identity, for instance, or to rediscover who they are, or to rebuild a sense of life, a personal identity. Who am I now that this person is physically absent from my life? What are the things that really matter to me? And the same sort of thing with an existential challenge right there is, what's the purpose of my life now that this person is physically absent? I want to acknowledge some of this great work comes from the writings of Therese Randall, of whom I'm a fan as well. But how do you work with people, for example, who are experiencing a sense of diminished personal identity? For example, I feel like I feel personally diminished, or a restricted sense of life purpose. So, you know, once again, kids like this can just simply look depressed, or they can look unmotivated, for example, and lethargic. It's like, I don't care about my future. Well, if you actually believe that you're not going to have a good future because the person you cared about so deeply is no longer going to be there to cheerlead and celebrate, or actually help you to be able to achieve your goals, et cetera, it can be profoundly demoralizing. And so how can we help people to be able to develop a sense of life purpose and to restore or remember a sense of personal identity to build on that? In many cases, it's not just simply reminiscing about the person. It's also really reflecting on their values. What are the things that they really cared about? And are those values, for example, that either in terms of carrying on their legacy or in terms of even deciding who I am now moving forward, that I actually want to incorporate in my own sense of life purpose, for example, and my own sort of guiding sense of moral conscience and the values that I actually wanted to carry forward in the world. So it's really fun, to be honest, and enriching to be able to work with even teenagers, you know, about this sense of life purpose, et cetera. In many cases, they've had experiences that have led to a great developmental acceleration. You know, teenagehood is a time when you're sort of think you're immune from risks. And here they've actually had devastating losses or life-threatening experiences themselves. So in many cases, they're more sober than the average teenager. And to be able to actually work with them therapeutically and to be able to focus on who they are, their guiding sense of morality and purpose, why they, you know, what they have to look forward to in the future, for example, can be really powerful and poignant work. With respect to circumstance-related distress, we revisited on that a little ago. But in many cases, once again, that has to come up with a socially constructive response to the ways in which the person died. So in many cases, that can focus on advocacy, or people can get involved, for example, on helplines. Many of the kids we worked with, for example, overseas, they appeared on local radio and they advocated, or they shared with their friends and they recommended that they be seen by that school council or join the group, et cetera. But there are lots of different ways in which people can be able to come up with a more constructive response to the way in which the person died. I would also like to just mention that part of this is actually recognizing that in wrongful death, it actually means that the social contract itself has been violated. That if you will, people did not do what needed or that they should have done to keep the person from dying. Now, some people may be angry at the deceased person for not taking better care of themselves, for example, or for taking their life. True. But in many cases, there is an injury to the social contract. We work with, you know, victims of school shootings over here, for instance, where there was a duty to protect. And you know, was that actually carried out properly? So just recognizing the fact that part of that work on circumstance-related distress, and that is dealing with how the person died, that involves also recognizing the role of the social contract and the importance of rebuilding and restoring and enforcing the social contract as a way of being able to move forward with your life. And in many cases, that means sort of making peace with what has happened through a candid conversation about what went wrong, and taking steps to actually try to rectify that so that other people are not similarly exposed in the future. So there are lots of different ways, but these are some different ideas in which we do that. But you know, how can non-clinicians get involved in that? It's just to recognize the fact that in many cases people want to become involved, and they will channel their energy, for example, their anger over how the person died, for instance, can get you into trouble. If you're really focusing on retaliation, what are some constructive ways in which we can actually deal with our pain and our sense of indignation over how a person died?
Thank you so much. So I think we have time for one last question. It's been a really, really productive discussion. But regarding future directions of the field in resilience, so do you think, with the rise of technology or artificial intelligence, where I've seen videos where the children of a deceased mom would put her voice into like a soft toy or something, and then you press a button and you can hear sort of your mom saying, I love you, or things like that. Do you think such technology will help grieving individuals better in their healing journey?
Those are actually some therapeutic ideas that we're working on, you know, at present right there. But if you focus, for example, on fostering a sense of continuing connection, then once again, we can think about how that actually helps people to be able to engage in, if you will, grief work. So my thoughts on that are that there's a lot of potential, but much like, for example, when we talk about complex trauma, for instance, is that interpersonal trauma, like abuse, for example, and exploitation, takes interpersonal healing. I would argue that interpersonal loss, like grieving, takes interpersonal healing, if you will, and recovery. And so I just would like to emphasize that notwithstanding all of those wonderful things that can happen, that being able to really connect with other people, oftentimes other people who've been through similar grief experiences, is cannot be overrated. Now, if I will, I'm interrupting our conversation here. There are a couple of ideas that I want to record here, and then I'll let you use your own discretion about whether to use them. So we're talking about the future, where the field can actually resolve or evolve in the future. I had a couple of ideas right here. One of them is, if we're talking about ways in which the field can evolve in the future, I'm revisiting some of the concepts that I recently laid out in 2004, and that is, we need to identify concepts that actually work. We're making a distinction makes a difference. So a lot of people, for example, will use the term protective factor. This is actually a paper that I wrote with my friend Joe Ruzak and a talented graduate student by the name of Kelly Dixon. But protective factor in many ways is actually overrated. What you really want is you want promotive factors. There are lots of different reasons why, but promotive factors are things like nourishment, for example, and nurturance. Promotive factors work for everybody all the time. So they're like proper nutrition and sleep and parents cuddling you. Protective factors are a lot more like immunization shots. So you actually have to have a matching hypothesis. You have to be immunized against the correct pathogen, or it's not going to work. And you're actually, it has to be timely. That is, you actually have to be up on your shots, or it can actually weaken over time. So protective factors, to be honest, I think are overrated. In many cases, people should be focusing on promotive factor. Same sort of a thing. Everybody talks about resilience, and resilience is a great thing. But we would actually argue in our paper that that stress resistance in many occasions is actually preferred. So I could talk about different types of trajectories, but for us, resilience is only one of a whole family of different types of trajectories. Stress resistance is generally better for the same reason that not getting sick is usually better than getting sick and rebounding quickly. So in our estimation, in many circumstances, resilient recovery is actually the second most desirable outcome. Stress resistance is typically better than, of course, protracted recovery, et cetera. And so we would just argue that that kind of conceptual clarity and the elaboration of our vocabulary really matters. And so I would also argue that many people oftentimes don't conceptually distinguish between a vulnerability factor, which is a moderator variable, and a causal risk factor, which actually exerts a direct causal effect. But we need to get this level of specificity in our language if we're going to be able to model them properly. Too many papers that I've read actually just sort of enumerate demographic characteristics, for example, as vulnerability factors without doing a formal test of moderation. So once again, if we're going to be focusing on advancing the field, I would once again talk about a commensurate evolution of both theory and research methods. And the theory really needs to do a lot of work on the primary four functions of theory, and that is description, explanation, prediction, and therapeutic control.
Thank you so much. I think our time is almost up. I really had a great time listening to your thoughts on the past, the present research, and of course the future directions. I hope this was productive and useful for you. Sure. As well. Yeah. And thank Sure. you for your time.
Enjoy.
The Resilience Research Group is a global group of researchers, practitioners, charities, and organizations dedicated to developing high-quality collaborative resilience research. Our aims are to improve access to, understanding of, and quality of resilience research, and to support and aid our members in effectively developing and disseminating their research. To find out more or to get involved, contact us on Twitter or LinkedIn.